On va commencer avec notre deuxième table ronde, qui, sous certains aspects, a bien été introduite par des réflexions qu'on a eues dans la première, notamment celle de Alexandra Schaeffer. C'est l'Europe maintenant. Des historiens indiens ont parlé de l'Europe comme d'une province. Il y a un fameux livre qui est apparu qui touche à l'idée que l'Europe est devenue une province du monde. Aucun doute qu'on ne soit pas plus le monde entier comme on prétendait être en 19e siècle. On est peut-être une région, et si on est une région, quelle politique on peut faire dans un espace régional, qui est la question qui est sous-tendue à tout notre colloque. C'est sur ça qu'on va discuter maintenant, à partir de la Russie, qui est un acteur bien remarquable dans l'actualité et l'histoire de l'Europe. Et donc, je demande à André Kortunov de prendre la parole. Il est le directeur du Conseil russe des affaires internationales et il est aussi, je lis dans sa petite biographie que nous pouvons lire, le président de New Eurasia Foundation. Ça, c'est très important. Moi, je travaille dans une université dans laquelle on a maintenant une chaire d'études euro-asiatiques parce qu'on est en train d'imaginer que la Russie garde cette double possibilité d'un regard à ouest et d'un regard à est. Et donc que l'Europe soit une partie de l'Asie plutôt que l'Asie une partie de l'Europe, comme on a peut-être imaginé dans le passé. Donc je le remercie. 15 minutes, as we have said. Please.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. Avant tout, je dois dire que je suis enchanté de venir à Paris et de participer à cette conférence très intéressante, très importante. Je n'ai pas de courage à parler le français ici, et c'est pourquoi je parle l'anglais, si je puisse. And let me start with the lyrical digression. I think that when we are talking about real challenges to the international stability in the 21st century, Russia is not one of them. I think that when future historians are likely to describe our period, they would focus on other challenges and other threats which are much more fundamental. The conflict between Russia and the West, in my opinion, is at least partially accidental. I think that it is a result of ignorance on the one side and negligence on the other. If you take Middle East, then the problems are indeed much more serious. You have a different concept of civilization, a different concept of modernity, and you have a world of at least 400 million people, and a demographic explosion, and the lack of feasible economic and social models, and growing environmental problems. So I think that this is really the problem that we are going to face in years to come. However, since I have to talk about Russia and Europe, let me focus on this issue for the time being. Of course, today nobody would deny that the relations between Russia and the West are undergoing a deep crisis. Arguably, the most serious crisis since the end of the Cold War. The current levels of mistrust, suspicions, negative attitudes, and outright animosities on both sides are very high. And many observers on both sides consider the situation to be abnormal, and they consider it to be saturated with serious risks and dangers. The situation might be detrimental to long-term interests of both Russia and the West. However, let me present you a slightly contrarian view on the subject. Let us get back to predictions and assumptions made 3.5 years ago after the crisis had erupted, and compare these predictions and assumptions with the situation today, in June of 2017. In my opinion, the overall situation in Europe has demonstrated more resilience and more stability than many of us had anticipated. Indeed, the Minsk agreements have never been implemented in full, but on the other hand, there has been no major escalation in East Ukraine. Separatists have not attempted to seize Mariupol, while the Ukrainian army has not tried to capture Donetsk and Lugansk. Of course, the mill-to-mill contacts between Russia and NATO have not been restored, but on the other hand, there has been no single collision between Russian and NATO military or civil aircrafts or combat ships. No inadvertent or accidental escalation has happened. The war of sanctions and counter-sanctions continues, and it's not likely to stop anytime soon, but neither Russia nor Ukraine faces an unavoidable economic collapse or feels a strong pressure to change its current policies. Now, the four NATO battalions are deployed close to Russian borders. Russia is deploying three divisions close to NATO, but we don't see a real arms race in Europe. So what I would say that the situation between Russia and the West reminds drôle de guerre, si je puisse, drôle de guerre or funny war, the initial period of the Second World War. If you remember, when the war had already started, had already been announced, but no major military operations were conducted. Now, we need to find an explanation to the resilience of the post-Ukrainian modus vivendi in Europe. And I can offer you at least three explanations, you can choose any to your liking. First of all, one can argue that the problem is that we don't have the intellectual courage to propose out-of-the-box solutions for the problems that the West and Russia confront. Academics are too traditional. They might stick to political correctness, and therefore politicians continue repeating their old mantras instead of offering new approaches and advancing new proposals. In my opinion, this explanation does not hold water. I think that during the last 3.5 years, a lot of interesting, creative, innovative ideas, concepts, and even detailed roadmaps were generated within the international intellectual community. All the good advice is already on the table. The second explanation boils down to the conclusion that both Russia and the West continue believing that time is playing on their side, and that we might be approaching a tipping point in the conflict. In Moscow, they might think that multiple unresolved crises within the European Union or the unpredictable future of the transatlantic alliance or the Ukraine fatigue in the West will make the trick. On the other hand, one can imagine that in Europe and in the West at large, they think that these growing pressures on the Russian economy will gradually erode the popularity and even legitimacy of the current political regime, so Russia will be forced to make more concessions. I think that we can consider this explanation. However, this explanation was already in use 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So the question is, you know, nothing in my opinion suggests that either side is on the brink of a capitulation or even on the brink of taking a more flexible position due to growing political or economic pressures or distractions caused by other pending problems. And finally, the third explanation is arguably the most pessimistic, but I consider it to be the most plausible as well. I think that the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West in this specific format and at this particular level serves important interests on both sides. For the Russian leadership, it helps to maintain the needed level of political mobilization. It gives more authority and status to the military. It keeps oligarchs on a short leash. And it justifies less than satisfactory performance of the Russian economy. On the other hand, the crisis with Russia helped to reinvent NATO, to rediscover the enemy of convenience, and even to find a new foundation for the challenged European identity. Let me remind you that sanctions against Russia remain one of very few foreign policy matters on which EU members can still keep consensus. That doesn't mean that both sides are happy with the current situation. Apparently, they are not. However, the situation appears to be acceptable for both sides, especially because the last 3.5 years have not resulted with an uncontrolled escalation or other unpredictable negative developments. So what we see is a situation of managed confrontation, which creates not only serious challenges, but also tangible opportunities for the two sides confronting each other. On the other hand, I think it would be fair to say that the likely political costs of changing the current policies appear to be high for Moscow and for Brussels. The changes, the costs associated with changes are definitely higher than the costs associated with maintaining status quo. Now, what can be done? And here let me give you my concept of the future resilient European security order. I think that, and my concept is based on the assumption that both Russia and the West in the end of the second decade of the 21st century are weak rather than strong corporate actors. Neither can pursue a truly consistent, unambiguous, long-term foreign policy, fully segregated from a variety of partisan, regional, economic, professional, and other group interests. Furthermore, these groups not only influence policies at the state level, they also become independent players in international relations. And therefore, what I would propose is what I label as a hybrid security system in Europe in future. Actually, you know, this adjective hybrid has become quite popular in the modern academic slang. They talk about hybrid regimes, about hybrid wars, about hybrid economic models. Usually it has a kind of negative connotation. However, there are some good things about hybrid. For example, you can take a hybrid vehicle, which combines a traditional internal combustion engine on the one hand and a more advanced electric motor on the other. So I think that what we have to do, if we consider the European security to be a vehicle, we should combine two engines, the old one, and in our particular case, it will be the old Cold War security system, and the new one. Let me just dwell very briefly on both. I think that with all the reservations we might have about the Cold War period, the Cold War system in Europe was relatively stable, relatively reliable, and relatively predictable. It included multiple channels of political communications. It included mill-to-mill contacts. It included risk reduction measures and arms control agreements. It also implied a certain level of mutual respect and even trust. So I think that we can probably get back to the Cold War system. It's not a great proposal, but I think it's better than nothing. We can do it through the NATO-Russia Council, through certain OSCE mechanisms, through sub-regional institutions, and in ad hoc formats as well. However, I think that the Cold War system is not good enough for us. And there are a couple of liabilities of the system which are evident today more than ever before. First of all, the Cold War system is static, not dynamic. It is spectacularly change resistant, but it can crumble instantaneously, as it happened already once in the late 1980s. Second, the Cold War system was based on two hierarchical organized military alliances, which divided Europe between the two superpowers. Today, no division of Europe is feasible or acceptable. The spheres of influence concept has lost its legitimacy, at least in the West. Third, the Cold War system addressed security challenges of the 20th century, and though some of these challenges are still with us, definitely there are many new challenges of the 21st century, including threats generated by non-state players. This is not something that the Cold War system was supposed to respond to. And finally, the Cold War system was relatively efficient when Russia and the West were almost completely isolated from each other, and therefore they could act as strong corporate actors. Today, with porous borders, cross-border travel, a lot of economic interdependence, multiple identities, numerous autonomous group interests, and so on, both Russia and the West emerge as weak corporate actors, which means that the rigid skeleton of the Cold War system becomes very fragile and unreliable. Therefore, I think that we should think about this electric motor in addition to the old internal combustion engine. And I think that by electric motor here, I mean a system of pan-European and sub-regional regimes, preserving and expanding remaining common space between Russia and the West. The odds are that today we have high chances to proceed with this task in non-security areas like education, research, or culture. However, one could also consider a variety of new security challenges where such approach can be applied. For example, international terrorism, international migrations management, drugs traffic, cross-border crime, energy security, and even cyber crimes. The regime approach can also be applied to sub-regional problems, the Arctic region, the Black Sea zone, the Balkans. We might be able to take one issue after another or to handle them in a parallel way. The regime approach, in my opinion, has a couple of evident comparative advantages if we compare it to the old Cold War system. Regimes are more flexible than institutions. They do not need to negotiate very complex and ambiguous decision-making processes. Many regimes do not require ratification procedures, which is clearly an advantage under the circumstances. Regimes are more democratic. They can embrace any party, including non-state actors, NGOs, international organizations, and trans-border movements. It is important to engage additional constituencies of stakeholders, and that can be done through regimes easier than through institutions. Finally, let me say that, of course, this idea of a hybrid security system in Europe can be questioned, at least on two assumptions. One can say that this is another disguise for the appeasement policy, that basically it's a concession that the West grants to Russia without any particular changes in the Russian behavior. The second argument might, you know, you can say that it is very difficult to separate the two layers, that if you don't have trust, if you have a confrontation, it would be very difficult to preserve these pan-European security regimes, even in marginal areas. And I think that both arguments deserve consideration. However, let me underscore once again my point. I'm talking about weak corporate actors, which means that maintaining the security regimes or cooperation regimes in Europe, you do not necessarily reward the Russian leadership. Likewise, you know, I think that you can develop particular links and contacts with interested groups of stakeholders, which do not necessarily mean that you are making concessions. For example, you know, if you take a university professor, the odds are that and he or she will have more in common with his or her partners in the other side of Europe than with the next door lieutenant colonel who serves on ICBM launchers. So I think that this is something that is different between today and the situation that we had in the middle of last century. It will be difficult. I think that it's a long road. I don't expect any revolutions right now. I think that the system itself will require a lot of nitty-gritty details to work on, but it shouldn't be an excuse not to move in this direction. Thank you.
Merci, Monsieur Koutounov. Très, très clair, très, très rapide aussi. Je vous en remercie. Et là, donc, il faut acheter une voiture hybride, si j'ai bien compris. Il faut. Qu'est-ce que, si vous l'avez déjà fait, on est bien installé dans les relations Russie-Europe. Sinon, il faut l'acheter. C'est-à-dire qu'il faut, vous l'avez très bien dit, marcher avec une petite ressource ou une grande ressource. Là, c'est pas très évident dans votre speech, qui est encore la guerre froide, Cold War. Et de l'autre côté, il faut nuancer les choses avec une diplomatie qui rejoint là, dans la discussion générale, je voudrais peut-être reprendre ça d'un point de vue historique, ce que vous disiez à propos des États-Unis, c'est-à-dire les stakeholders, on va renouveler les agents diplomatiques, on va parler à la société plutôt que à la politique. Ça pose des questions pour un historien fascinantes, mais on les verra après. Maintenant, je passe la parole à M. Hans Maul, qui nous parlera de l'ordre européen vu de Berlin, c'est-à-dire de d'où en général il faut toujours le regarder. Et M. Maul est en même temps, il travaille dans la Stiftung für Wissenschaft und Politik de Berlin. À vous et merci.
Thank you very much, Chairman, and please forgive me and allow me to continue in French. I'd like to thank the organizers of this meeting, and this is not just a platitude. I'm delighted and very encouraged to see, and I want to congratulate the College and Michel Fouché for focusing our interest on the context of international crises. I have myself been obsessed by this concern about the context of crises, because over the last years I have experienced a creeping impression that something was wrong here in the way international politics worked and the way international order functioned. And I think this creeping suspicion is indeed focused on this context. Let me just note here with a footnote an interesting cultural difference which seems to exist between East Asian and European people. East Asians focus more on the context. When they're shown a painting or a photograph, Europeans will immediately look at the person in the photograph. Chinese or Asian, East Asian people will look at the background. So this focus on the context may be something which East Asian cultures are better in than we Europeans, but I think, or Westerners, but I think we have to learn that. And so in that sense, I'm really grateful and happy to be here and congratulate you on picking on this theme. Now, Michel, you have introduced already quite a few descriptions of the international order with adjectives and metaphors, and at the same time you have indicated your dissatisfaction with the state of affairs. I agree with you. I still basically, after having worked on this theme for 3 years now, and just completed an edited volume in English, I'm still basically struggling with understanding what's happening. But I'll add another description to your list. My description, which I hope to be able to explain in the next 15 minutes or so, is what we are observing in international order is a synchronous failure. Or you could also say a synchronized failure. I hope this is clear enough for the translation. In other words, things are going wrong all over the place and they are influencing each other, to put it in very simple terms. Now, I've been asked here to talk about the European order. Let me just reflect a little bit on this term of political order. I think any political order has to do three things. It has to deal with the realities of power in some form. In some way, it always has to deal with power, the distribution of power in the system, if you like. The second thing is it has to resolve conflicts between the people in the order. And the third objective is to allow people to live together reasonably well in a collective. So when we talk about the international order, we are talking about mankind, but also the society of states. And this sort of living well reasonably, living reasonably well together, usually I would argue, always implies some kind of values and even a vision. That vision may be very crude, but I cannot envisage a political order without some basic values. It's just a question of what the values are. So that's what I have in mind when I talk about political order. One conclusion I would draw from that, and I apologize to the organizers for this because I'm going to be rather critical with one concept which has been figured importantly so far, it's the concept of the equilibre, the balance. Balance is just one of the many mechanisms which you can display in the context of a political order. And I think today the notion that balance is useful, I would challenge that. I think balance is a misleading concept in the sense that if you have to govern, it may not be particularly helpful to have a balance of power or an equilibre. First of all, it has been pointed out already by you, Mr. Chairman, that you know to deal with dynamic equilibriums is extremely complicated. But more importantly, equilibrium can also imply, for instance, veto power. And veto power is a recipe for not being able to govern at all. So my suggestion is we are used to, we are socialized as international relations scholars, we are deeply socialized into using this balance of power concept. It is no longer very useful if the context of political order is taken seriously. Now, let me turn to the European order, because after all, I've been asked to talk about the European order and not about the international order. But the reason why I started the way I did is, as you'll see, I consider the two profoundly linked. I think when you talk about European order, you also, in the end, have to talk about the international order. But Wang Jizi, earlier on, you raised the rightly, I think, the issue, what is a region? You know, if we can't be sure if there are difficulties in defining a region, then obviously there are also difficulties in defining orders, regional order. What is a regional order in Europe? I will talk about seven different notions of order in Europe, regional order in Europe. And let me go through these seven different definitions of regional order in Europe, one after the other. The first is the European Union. The European Union, not quite sure, minus the United Kingdom probably, or not yet minus the United Kingdom, but let's say the inner circle, or one definition of the European order is the European Union and its internal workings. This obviously already is a very complex political order, but it is a realm which clearly also is governed, and it does the three things which I set out at the beginning as the objectives which political orders have to meet. I would also say very bluntly, frankly, and I'm very pro-European, still I will say very bluntly that I consider the European Union to be badly governed. This is a very complex judgment, you know, it's the bottom line of a very complex case, but let me just put it in those terms here. The European Union is a political order which is not particularly well governed and in need of reform and innovation. The second political European political order is what you could call the Western European order. This would include a United Kingdom which has left the European Union, and obviously that's a very important issue here, and also Norway and Switzerland and Liechtenstein. I mean, these are in many ways are part of the European Union, but in other ways they are not, and therefore there is another European order, and the way this European order is going to be shaped in the future and to what extent it will be able to function as a political order will very much depend on the results of Brexit. It will depend on the way Brexit goes and the kind of debris and collateral damage the Brexit negotiations will produce. The third European order is what you could call the pan-European order. This is more security-based. This pan-European order, again, it's not so easy to define it geographically, but I would suggest that this pan-European order consists of the Western European order plus Eastern Europe, that is Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and the southern periphery of the European Union, Turkey, certainly, the Israeli-Arab conflict zone, Northern Africa. So it's Western Europe plus the Eastern and Southern neighborhoods. And of course, we also have European policies already towards this. Organizationally and institutionally, we do not really have a very good fit, but you could argue that the OSCE roughly corresponds to the institutional, or is trying institutionally, organizationally, to manage this pan-European order. So this is the third order we have. Then we have the fourth and the fifth European orders. And the fourth and the fifth European orders are competing notions of order. One is what you just talked about. In your hybrid order, you could call it a greater Europe, or you could call it the common European home, as Mikhail Gorbachev called it. It's a notion of Europe which includes Russia, possibly also includes the United States. So this is order number four, or number five. The alternative concept is the transatlantic order. The European order, including the United States or North America, and of course the institutional organizational context of that is NATO. Now, NATO is deeply part of the European order, undeniably, still. But it is, as I said, it is just one sort of additional layer of the European order. And then we have the global order, and I mentioned earlier on that I do consider, or I do look at the issue of political order, and in fact at the issue of politics also, as a seamless web. You know, I would argue it makes more sense to look at order as a continuum political order, a continuum which starts at the local level and it ends at the global level. And at each level, you know, you can analytically distinguish, of course, the levels, but they are interrelated, they are interlinked, and therefore the global level also has considerable importance for the European level. Not least because the global order will define in important ways, as we heard before, the power configurations, the way power is handled at the global level, and also the rules of the game, which are important for Europe. At the global level, my perception of the international order and the way the old liberal international order, Michel, you talked about this already a bit, how the old liberal international order has been transforming and changing, it's moving into a direction where we have a new kind of bilateralism, or bipolarity even. A new kind of bipolarity with the two poles of China and the United States. That seems to me, you know, inevitable tendency, and there's considerable evidence for this happening already. As the international order erodes and becomes weaker, the central power poles, which are still the United States and increasingly China, and their relationship with each other becomes more and more important. More and more important, of course, means that a lot will depend on that relationship for the future of the world, including for the future of the European order. And let me just point out that through its new, what I would define, grand strategy of the One Belt, One Road, China is already trying to create linkages into the European world, into the European order. So OBOR is an important dimension which brings China into this European order as well, and through the global order and its global strategy. So the relationship between the United States and China, I argued, is increasingly becoming a core axis in the international order, an axis which is defined, and that's of course fundamentally different from the Cold War, by huge interdependence between the United States and China on the one hand, but lots of conflicting issues on the other hand. So it's interdependence plus conflict objectives. So managing that relationship will not be easy. But the management of this relationship will also be important for managing global issues. In other words, how well the Security Council of the United Nations will be able to function in the future will depend, importantly, on the relationship between the United States and China. How global warming will be managed will depend, importantly, on the relationship of the United States and China. What we have seen with the Paris Agreement, I think, might be a paradigm for what I'm talking about. Because if you look more closely, what you find is you first of all had a bilateral agreement at the margins of APEC between Obama and President Xi on, you know, mutual agreement on policies towards global warming. And then you had the Paris Agreement, which, because it was well organized and France, as the inviting country, played a marvelous role diplomatically, was able to sort of expand the parameters of the agreement somewhat. But basically, the agreement was possible only because this mutual adjustment of the United States and China. So that's what we're talking about. Now, when there is so much at stake in the US-China relationship for Europe or for the rest of the world, then it seems to me obvious that it becomes very important that the European Union be in a position to be a meaningful interlocutor or a significant other, I always say. This is a bit of a jargon, I apologize. The US-China relationship needs a significant other who in situations of crisis can say, wait a minute, calm down. We have an idea, perhaps you can help. This position of a significant other is vacant at the moment. You know, perhaps Russia, but I have doubts. I think Russia is not really in this position. Perhaps in 20 years, India could be a significant other, or 30 years, I don't know. But in the short to medium term, only the European Union has this potential to be a significant other. And at times in the past, it has played this role already. There are a few, unfortunately, very few instances, but there are a few instances where I could point out to you, I don't do that now, for reasons of time, but I could explain how the European Union did play this role collectively. So, in other words, it is, I think, the most important challenge to me in the context of the future of Europe, how the European Union can organize itself to be that meaningful interlocutor, the significant other, and being a significant other implies that the European Union will have to develop a capacity to be a global player. Not necessarily in the old ways of a superpower or a great power, but it needs the capacity to be a global player. That's where we stand at the moment. It seems to me that is the great challenge. Now, I have talked about six political orders now. Here's the seventh. I think the most important political order of all is the national political order. International order is built on national political orders. And my perception, and you mentioned that, and we've heard it from others this morning already as well, you mentioned the weak collective players, weak collective actors, Russia, weak collective actor, European Union, weak collective actor, United States. It seems to me that it is part of the situation of today that the nation state, national politics are profoundly challenged all over the place. This is not just a problem of fragile states. It's not just a problem of failing states, although this obviously is sort of dramatizing the issues. But I would put it to you, that's my conclusion, that politics is facing profound challenges. And those challenges materialize first of all and most of all at the national level. So you cannot hope to have a functioning international order if you don't have functioning national orders which are interested in making international order work. And I mean, the analysis which you have heard just before on Russia and the European Union ultimately points out, it seems to me, implicitly, that the weakness of governments mean that they're basically trying to cater to domestic political interests. I call that sometimes autism. I mean, it's a kind of autistic behavior I see in many foreign policies. Domestic politics is the relevant, relevant category you want to serve. The logic of the international situation, as I see it, is exactly the reverse. We would have to find ways and means, and again, this will, you know, first of all, a challenge for the European Union, to find ways and means to make domestic societies responsible to international constraints. Otherwise, I can't see how we're going to get through the next decades. So that's the bottom line to me. The national political order is where the key ultimately lies. And that's why it's very nice to be at this kind of fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Vous avez évoqué des sujets très importants. Vous avez parlé d'une balance qui n'est pas une balance et un équilibre, mais plutôt quelque chose de différent aujourd'hui. Mais enfin, vous êtes retourné à cette idée parce que la bipolarité que vous évoquez, la Chine et les États-Unis, le dernier niveau de votre... Enfin, ils ont besoin d'une Europe, peut-être d'une Russie. Ils ont besoin de quelqu'un qui leur dit « calme-toi, j'ai une solution ». Et l'Europe a des difficultés à le faire. Là, votre conclusion sur les États nationaux est très intéressante. Vous avez parfaitement raison. Il y a des politiques domestiques qui sont peut-être le premier pas de la construction de cet édifice que vous... Mais c'est vrai aussi que pour les Européens, et là je quitte la discussion parce que il faut... C'est vrai aussi que les politiques intérieures, les politiques domestiques que vous évoquez, sont bien influencées par cette supranationalité qui n'est pas un État, qui est l'Europe. Donc la chose que vous évoquez d'abord, c'est-à-dire la faiblesse de l'Europe, une Europe qui existe mais qui est mal gouvernée, et enfin le sujet sous-tendu dans votre relation, si j'ai bien compris, c'est-à-dire qu'en réalité, les politiques extérieures ou intérieures des États, maintenant dans l'Union, dépendent strictement des solutions de l'Europe et évoquent aussi, en France comme en Italie, des anti-européismes qui donnent encore plus de faiblesse à cette possibilité. Merci vraiment. Vous nous faites réfléchir et ça va continuer et se conclure avec un ordre européen vu de Londres. Et la parole est à Ian Bond, ancien ambassadeur anglais et maintenant directeur de Foreign Policy Center for European Reform à Londres. Merci, monsieur.
Thank you very much, Luigi. I suppose I should start actually by correcting you. I was never ambassadeur anglais.
Non.
Ambassadeur du Royaume-Uni.
Je regardais vers l'avenir, vous savez. Je pensais avoir la condition de...
Well, I hope it doesn't come to that. But that does give me a nice starting point. Before I start, I want to say a big thank you to Michel Fouché. It's just over a dozen years since we first met in Riga, not long after Latvia and its neighbors had joined the EU and NATO, and in some ways had marked a new stage in the development of a regional order in Europe. It was very interesting times to be there, to see the development of a country just after it had joined these international organizations. And I'm absolutely delighted to be here with Michel chez soi à Paris, to have this opportunity. I suppose that I have to start with a comment on the political chaos that is gripping the UK at the moment, because it's actually rather difficult to talk about a regional order in Europe from the perspective of a country which is doing its best to create disorder in Europe. I was going to say that the British government cannot agree on what kind of relations it wants to have with its European neighbours. I'm not even sure that I have a British government and that it's even capable of agreeing on what kind of relations it wants to have with itself. But here we are. It's almost exactly a year since the UK voted to leave the EU. We have not set out a clear vision of the European order or how the UK should fit into it, beyond platitudes about the importance of continued good relations with our neighbours. And so what I'm going to say has to make a certain number of assumptions about what kind of Europe the UK wants and what it will do in future. It's a good idea to look back, in a sense, to understand where we're going in the future, and to look back to 1973 and our rather belated accession to the European Economic Community, as it was then. We had tried to hold on to the pre-Second World War construct of the British Empire in a modified form through trading with the British Commonwealth and so on. And we had found that those relationships could not keep the UK prosperous while the rest of Europe was powering ahead without us. And so we knew in 1973 that we were turning our economic focus from the former empire, from the remnants of the empire, and instead looking in the direction of our European partners. And for the succeeding 40 years, I would say we have operated on the basis of a sort of three-legged stool, where we had NATO membership, and through that, the very close ties to the US that guaranteed our defense. We had the EEC and later the EU, and membership there guaranteed our economic security. And we had a permanent seat on the Security Council that guaranteed that we would have a major voice in any significant crisis that was affecting other parts of the world. Now, that's a gross simplification. There were other organizations which played important niche roles in British foreign policy thinking. Whether that's the Council of Europe or the OSCE, which played a particularly important part in managing the transition from the Cold War of division of Europe, which, you know, more or less, with the exception of the conflict in Yugoslavia, took place more or less peacefully. But the structures that we have relied on are now being challenged, or we're challenging them, frankly. You can make an intellectual case that after the end of the Cold War, we should ourselves have invested more in trying to devise new security architecture, but we didn't. We gave new jobs to the institutions that we already had, and for the UK at the time, that suited us quite well. And you can say that in some ways it's been quite successful. If you compare what happened to the countries that emerged from empires at the end of the First World War in Europe and the fate that they suffered in the 20 or 30 years after the end of the First World War with what has happened since the end of the Cold War, we've done a lot better to create stable and relatively prosperous states which are part of a small sea community in Europe. But at the same time, the successes that we had have sowed the seeds of the UK's current Brexit problems. And I'm not sure that I can fully explain this, but somehow the UK accepted the logic that we could defend ourselves more effectively if we were committed to others in the framework of NATO and willing to put our armed forces on the line in a conflict through NATO, that defended us better than if we tried to act on our own. But a significant part of the British political class did not accept that logic in relation to our economic security, or indeed to things like law enforcement cooperation and the fight against terrorism, as that was expressed through the EU. Instead, a large part of the British political class thought that we could operate better from outside than from inside the EU. So what does that mean for our vision of Europe after Brexit? Well, on the one hand, you might think that with these rather autarkic views about how best to guarantee certain aspects of our security now being quite prevalent among particularly members and MPs of the Conservative Party, that the UK would actually be preparing to strike out on its own to take advantage of the freedom that it has after Brexit to pursue a rather different approach to European security, to look for new partners, and indeed even to encourage other countries to follow it out of the EU. And there have been some people who've suggested that. There are still a number of the most Eurosceptic figures in the UK who say that we should only be the first to leave and that others should follow us out of the door and that it would be a good thing if the European Union fell apart. There's been at least one suggestion on a prominent conservative website that the UK should align itself with Russia and against the EU if its former partners don't give it what it's asking for in the negotiations on Brexit. And there are some people among Conservative MPs who believe that the UK should in fact adopt a position of isolation. I won't call it splendid isolation. You could only really do that in the days when we had a big empire behind us. But that somehow we should withdraw ourselves from European quarrels and stay out of foreign entanglements entirely. And you saw this expressed quite clearly in the number of Conservative MPs who voted against getting involved in airstrikes on Syria in 2013, when we would have been aligning ourselves with France and with the US had we gone ahead and done that. And in fact, it was our decision, or the decision of the House of Commons, not to go down that road, that in some ways broke that triangular consensus that something had to be done about the chemical weapons strikes in that year. But I think those isolationist views and those views in favor of European anarchy are very much a minority view still in the British political class as a whole, and I think that may be a good thing. The government will probably not issue its next national security strategy until 2020, but when it comes out, I would expect that it will be a small C conservative document with a rather cautious approach to European order. The reality is that even after Brexit, our interests will remain pretty similar to what they are now, we will be forced to adapt the way that we pursue them. And you get a hint of this in the government's recent white paper on Brexit, which says the UK wants the EU to succeed. It is in our interests for it to prosper politically and economically, and a strong new partnership with the UK will help to that end. So we're slightly in the world of Lampedusa, where everything must change for everything to stay the same. But if you take some concrete examples, in the area of counter-terrorism and law enforcement, the UK has made very clear that it wants to carry on working with the EU. There are some technical and legal issues in the way of that, and I think some of them are going to be quite hard to overcome. But what's striking is that the UK is not challenging the basic logic that if terrorists and criminals cross borders, then the data needed to catch them has to cross borders, and you have to have cross-border mechanisms for extradition, for investigation, and so on. And that the best way of dealing with that is through the existing mechanisms like Europol and Eurojust, and not through trying to create a new network of bilateral mechanisms. I suspect that we will continue also to be concerned about how the EU polices or fails to police its external borders, and that we will continue to take part, even with a reduced voice, in CSDP operations designed to tackle irregular migration via the Mediterranean and in efforts to get EU personnel on the ground in Libya. It's a very challenging operation. But the logic of it, the reason for trying to put the EU's external border, effective external border, as far forward as possible, is, it seems to me, unavoidable. In terms of hard defence, I think NATO will not only remain central, it will, if anything, become more central to our concept of how we defend ourselves. Our threat perception has not changed. We are not reconfiguring British forces to defend against a potential French invasion, at least for the time being. So I think that if our economic situation permits, I would expect us, if anything, to be doing more in a NATO context to compensate for the fact that we will have less influence on the EU side. The biggest threat to that is Donald Trump and his attitude to NATO. And this brings me to one of the key points, which is that I sketched out this three-legged stool. What we have done is to cut one leg off. What Donald Trump seems to be doing is to cut another leg off. And I'm not sure that our membership of the UN Security Council on its own is enough to protect our security or to guarantee the security of the European region. It does seem to me that British politicians are trying to pretend that nothing has changed as a result of the election of Donald Trump, and that, albeit in the case of Angela Merkel rather cautiously, Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron are reacting more quickly to a big change in the situation. They're trying to nudge people towards accepting that something has changed. One thing I would say is that it's getting harder and harder to separate the military and the non-military threats. Fighting the so-called Islamic State in the Middle East has involved not only military efforts there, but also police intelligence operations in Europe, financial intelligence operations that go around the globe, operations in cyberspace against jihadi communications. And what that has underlined to me is that the old silos where, you know, NATO was NATO and the EU was the EU, when I served at NATO in the late 1980s, the idea that the NATO Secretary General and the President of the European Commission might meet was almost unimaginable. You know, the two were, I mean, it's just a few kilometers from the Rond-Point Schuman to Evere, but it might as well have been the whole width of the Atlantic Ocean. But that has changed quite significantly, and that's quite encouraging. If you look at the EU global strategy, which was published just a few days after last June's Brexit referendum, ironically, that underlines the extent to which the EU and NATO actually now see themselves working together. And I suspect that the UK is going to find that even after Brexit, its interest in seeing that cooperation continue is going to grow, not shrink. So just let me say in conclusion, in one way, you might have expected that after Brexit, the UK would have a bold new vision of European security to go along with this leap into the unknown that it was taking. The reality is that whether unfortunately or fortunately, it doesn't. It does not have a magic plan for some new set of institutions that could protect British security better than the institutions that already exist in Europe. And even as a non-member, I would expect that the UK will be looking to the EU to help to provide a European order that is based on the rule of law at home, strong defences abroad, and a foreign and security policy that responds to both domestic and foreign threats. And the problem for the UK is going to be that we will have less leverage to be able to achieve those objectives.
Thank you. Merci beaucoup. Vraiment, ce n'était pas facile d'aborder ce sujet, de trouver l'équilibre dans la situation actuelle des relations entre le Royaume-Uni et l'Europe. C'est une matière qui se fait de jour en jour en plus, donc c'est vraiment tout à fait compliqué, mais vous avez très bien résumé les mots-clés de cette situation. En plus, je vous remercie aussi en tant qu'Italien du Sud de votre citation du prince de Lampedusa, tout en vous rappelant que l'aristocratie sicilienne a toujours beaucoup aimé l'aristocratie, la noblesse anglaise. Elle a toujours regardé l'Angleterre comme une île avec laquelle elle pouvait un peu marchander surtout, mais surtout avoir une comparaison de son état envers l'Italie. Les Siciliens sont toujours des Italiens avec un bagage un peu léger. Donc ils sont des Siciliens, après ils sont des Italiens. Et le problème, je termine, je suscite en vous un petit débat. Le problème, c'est qu'en vous écoutant, on a l'impression que le monde actuel, on veut tous être connectés, mais chacun veut être indépendant dans cette connexion, qui peut-être va aboutir à quelque chose de très originel que nous n'arrivons pas à voir, mais qui ressemble compliqué à rejoindre, parce que rester connecté, avoir l'Europe, mais aussi les nations, avoir la défense de l'OTAN, mais en même temps avoir la possibilité de choisir, et les États-Unis restent un peu l'exemple de tout ça. Je vous remercie alors vous tous. Excusez-moi aussi d'avoir interprété d'une façon peu modérée, immodérée, mon rôle de modérateur, mais je vous laisse la parole. If you want to say anything to each other, to have answers, questions and answers, it's your...
If I may just take up your point, I think, Mr. Chairman, you have put it wonderfully precisely. Everybody is interdependent and dependent on others, but everybody wants to be independent. This defines the ultimate political paradox, it seems to me also. And what I, in that context, want to flag and have your responses on, and let me put it as a thesis, as a provocative thesis rather than a question. From that perspective, it seems to me that sovereignty is a fundamentalist ideological term which needs to be reconsidered very seriously. I find that the arguments about sovereignty are often misleading. They pretend independence where there is interdependence, and therefore the only ability to have an impact is through working with others, and to some extent to give up or at least qualify your sovereignty. So isn't the concern about sovereignty and the kind of fetish which it has become one of the key issues here?
I cannot miss an opportunity to engage into the discussion on sovereignty, because if sovereignty were a religion, then the Kremlin would be its cathedral these days. I think that this obsession with sovereignty is very characteristic, not only of Russia, but definitely Russia is a very, a vivid example. And I think the problem is exactly this mystification of sovereignty, which is considered almost like an icon. You can just look at it and you can pray, but we need to do, and I think this is the task of the scholarly community, we need to demystify sovereignty, because sovereignty is a capital that you can use. When you make an agreement with another partner, you yield a part of your sovereignty in exchange for something which should be more valuable for you. So I think that this is a big issue. And this is how and where we should confront populists who try to exploit this vision of sovereignty, because for them, sovereignty is synonymous of protection and stability. I think that at this next stage of the globalization process, it is critically important to prepare some kind of valid and explicit arguments on conditioned sovereignty and what we can get in exchange for yielding as part of our sovereignty to international borders. But let me also, if I might, no one mentioned here, this is a question I have for the European representatives here, nobody mentioned the role of the European Union as the rule setter in the world, as a model, as an institution which might be weak on soft power, but which is used quite often as a yardstick, as a point of departure. Because if you take international public law, with all due respect, the core of the system is not in the United States. The United States has very complicated relations with international public law. Take, for example, the Law of the Sea Convention and the United Nations, but it is Europe. If you take social standards, if you take environment, if you take many procedures, all of us, and I think that my colleagues from Asia would agree to that, we are all looking at Europe as a model, not at any other player. So I think that this particular feature of the European Union might be and should be very instrumental and important in building the new global governance. Because without this yardstick, it would be much difficult for all of us to relate our policies and our approaches to something which we consider model. Thank you.
Thank you. I think Andre makes a very important point about pooling sovereignty to achieve a greater overall effect. And I think that is one of the arguments that those of us who wanted the UK to remain in the EU were very unsuccessful at making. I suspect it's an argument that is, for many people, quite hard to make. It sounds quite abstract, but it is incredibly important, because the reality is, if I look in the foreign policy area at the goals that the British Foreign Office puts out as part of its business planning process, they overlap very neatly on almost every point with what the EU says it is setting out to achieve. And that's not a coincidence, because we and France, I think, has been as successful as we have been very successful in leveraging our membership of the European Union in order to pursue our foreign policy goals. There are many countries in the European Union for whom, say, the situation in Mali or the situation in Myanmar are pretty unimportant. There are a small number of countries, of whom we in France are two, for whom these countries are quite important. And it's by persuading the other 20-something that we have been able to have an impact on the situations in other countries. So I do think that that question of viewing sovereignty as some capital that you may put into a joint enterprise is really important.
J'ai encore une minute pour une... Oui, je peux encore utiliser les droits du modérateur. Je voudrais vous poser une question. Vous avez très bien évoqué le problème de la souveraineté, mais je pense que le problème, c'est la taille de la mosaïque qu'on est en train de composer. C'est-à-dire, si je prends mon Metternich, je vois qu'à l'époque, la taille était de grands États, les empires ont dit, et après, il y avait des États minuscules, des États moyens. Et on a imaginé, surtout, c'était l'Angleterre qui l'imaginait, que la taille devait un peu augmenter. Il fallait les États-nations. Pour jouer le jeu du international, il fallait jouer avec des cartes un peu plus petites d'un côté et plus grandes de l'autre. Aujourd'hui, je pense qu'on est dans une situation tout à fait à l'opposé. C'est-à-dire que l'État-nation devient une taille qui doesn't fit anywhere. Il est trop grand pour certains aspects, il pose trop de problèmes, et de l'autre côté, il est trop petit. Et c'est pour ça que nous sommes tous tiraillés. La France, non, mais c'est pour ça qu'elle fait... Elle est moins questionnée, mais elle est plus questionnée. Mais nous tous, nous sommes tiraillés. L'Allemagne, c'est plus compliqué encore. En tout cas, le Royaume-Uni a le problème maintenant aussi de l'Écosse, elle est petite. Les Espagnols ont le problème de la Catalogne, qui devient un problème de plus en plus important. Au mois de septembre, ils auront un plébiscite. On ne sait pas qu'est-ce qu'ils en feront, mais ils ont quelque chose qui commence à devenir la Catalogne république indépendante. Nous, en Italie, on le vit avec la Ligue du Nord, et on a eu la Yougoslavie dans les années 90. C'est-à-dire que peut-être le problème de la souveraineté aujourd'hui n'arrive plus à se poser à partir de l'État-nation. Mais le danger, c'est que l'État-nation va éclater, ne va pas se disposer dans de petites tailles d'une façon pacifique, comme d'ailleurs deux siècles auparavant, pour arriver à une taille moyenne à partir de grandes et de petites, des empires et des États régionaux, on a dû surmonter tout ce qu'on appelle le 19e et peut-être même une partie du 20e. Alors là, comment réussir à faire ça tout en utilisant une taille, une dimension, une sorte de qui n'est pas maniable pour le problème d'aujourd'hui?
If I may start, thank you for again posing a very important question. Yes, I think you rightly indicate that transformation of political orders, and I think that again applies at all levels, nation state level, regional level, global level, bears considerable risks. There's a considerable risk, it seems to me, particularly of violence, of war. Given the modern means of destruction, that could be terrible. I think there are reasons to worry about this. On the other hand, transformation just suggests there will be change. It can also be very constructive and positive changes. I think, to me, two concepts in this context are very important. Also explain part of the difficulties which we have. It seems to me that the kind of political malaise which we have in many Western countries, including even to some extent, we know this phenomenon in Germany too, this kind of political malaise has a lot to do with problems of irresponsible behavior of political elites, or elites in general. The way you put it before, everybody wants to be independent, but everybody is interdependent and vulnerable, therefore. You could describe this as irresponsible attitude. This is irresponsible not to recognize that you are interdependent. And I find that irresponsibility in that sense has been an important category in the politics, in domestic politics and in regional politics in Europe as well. So I would like to see more responsible behavior by elites. And of course, that also goes back to something you said, Andrei. The European Union as a role model, Yes, but it can do that legitimately and plausibly only if it plays by its own rules. And part of the reason why I said the European Union is not particularly well governed is that you can find many instances where the European Union says one thing but practices other things, or in the member states allows other practices to be conducted. So yes, if you want to define the rules, you also have to obey by them, obey the rules yourself. And this is in fact also a problem with the United States and China. I think both powers are profoundly ambivalent about the international order in that sense. You know, do we really want to be constrained by that order if it doesn't fit our plans? And that behavior you also find sometimes in the European Union. You know, we know the rules, but we'd like not to follow them. So that is also part of this issue of political responsibility. What does it mean to be responsible as a decision maker? But also there's a question to all of us as voters, you know, and citizens. What does it mean to be responsible as a citizen? I think this is also quite a legitimate and important question. The second concept I want to introduce here, and I apologize, this is Eurojargon. It's terrible, but I think it is in fact a very important concept. It's the concept of subsidiarity. Subsidiarity has long been paid lip service to in the context of European integration. If you look more closely, you actually find that the European integration process is deliberately and fundamentally designed in ways which are not compatible with subsidiarity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's shared responsibilities, but shared responsibilities is the opposite of subsidiarity. And I find this concept of subsidiarity also very meaningful as an answer to, you know, how can we make regional and global order more effective? I think it means starting with this notion of how can we best assemble the coalition of actors, of states and non-states actors, businesses, and NGOs to deal with the problems at hand. And if you take that issue of subsidiarity seriously, I think you would find that a lot is done in ways which do not correspond to this. So I think subsidiarity could be a starting point for the kind of political innovation which I think is very important.
Just very quickly on this question of whether, you know, the nation state is too large or too small a body to be useful any longer. And I think a lot depends on structure and the effectiveness of your governance. And I think this links perhaps to Hans's point about subsidiarity. And one of the problems with the UK is that we have gone from being an extremely centralized state 20 years ago, before devolution, to a situation where now we have a curious combination of an extremely centralized power in Westminster with asymmetric devolution. And that is creating tensions because it feels as though everything is being decided at the wrong level somehow. You know, some decisions which should be taken nationally are now taken subnationally. Many things which should be decided subnationally are still decided nationally. Now, you know, no human institution is perfect, but I think we have devised something which works particularly badly. I think there is a tension in the European Union between the economic logic of having a common set of rules so that you can trade across borders freely and so on, and the logic that there are many things, you know, there are many economic issues in which the EU shouldn't meddle, that national governments are perfectly capable of sorting them out for themselves. One thing I would definitely like to see is more involvement of national parliamentarians. And actually, one could make the argument that this goes well beyond the EU. If one looks at the OSCE, for example, as well. You know, we have parliamentary bodies. They're not always terribly good at providing an effective democratic input to the decision making.
About the major division lines in the globalized world. I think one of them is clearly a divide between winners and losers in the process of globalization. For some time, we thought that globalization, well, it's a win-win situation, but of course it is not. You know, there are those who can make and those who cannot catch up with the trends. And I think one of the problems with nation states today is that more and more often we see nation states acting as representatives and advocates of losers. You know, it's understandable. Of course, state has to take into account the interests of those who cannot make it or who cannot catch up for the time being. But I think that there is a danger there because that reflects the weakness rather than the strength of state, and the weakness rather than the strength of the concept of sovereignty. You know, the revolutionary France in the late 18th century was not preaching sovereignty. They wanted to expand, you know, the slogans, the principles of the French Revolution to the rest of Europe. It was not about sovereignty. If you take the Soviet Union in 1920s, it was not about sovereignty either. The idea was that, you know, we should share our new model with the rest of Europe and the rest of the world. So when now states stick to sovereignty, understandably, but it reflects the lack and deficit of vision and confidence, which in my view is dangerous because it can compromise the whole idea of state as building blocks of the international system. So in this sense, I think that clearly we all need more imagination, more vision, so we can bring into our coalition those who represent the forces of globalization, which unfortunately in many cases is not there.
Very interesting. Nous terminons ici et on vous remercie bien sûr de votre attention, de votre patience, mais je remercie all you for your participation and then we have perhaps a lunch, I hope. Thank you.
Vous pouvez applaudir les orateurs. Donc les orateurs de ce matin et de cet après-midi, les organisateurs sont invités à retourner dans la cour d'accueil pour le buffet et pour nous nous retrouverons à 14h pile pour la troisième table ronde dont je vous rappelle qu'elle prendra la forme d'une émission de radio de RFI ainsi que la quatrième table ronde. Elle n'en sera pas moins intéressante, bien sûr.